This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. I'm Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us. It's Friday, October 9th. Coming up this week, we'll unpack that Cohen Group report, which called into question the EPA's fairness in getting involved to block Pebble.
It's not pro-Pebble or anti-Pebble. This, again, is for good governance about the actions of a federal agency.
So says one side, but Pebble opposition was quick to denounce the report this week.
The notion that Secretary Cohen is kind of an independent third-party arbiter of disputes with EPA is ridiculous.
We'll hear from both. Plus, an update on how the incinerator at the Dillingham landfill, now 6 months old, is handling the city's waste.
Anywhere between 1,500 to 2,200 pounds of waste goes into the buckets, goes in the hopper, it burns, it just comes out at the end and a whole bunch of ash.
And we found some youngsters excited about a new fitness opportunity at the elementary school gym.
It's really fun because at the end, usually sometimes, it makes your hands real smooth. And there's some weird handholds which are fun to go over.
Stay with us, those stories and more coming up after a brief look back at some of the week's news. October is a month for elections, and voters cast ballots in cities and boroughs and tribal councils all over Southwest Alaska this week. Most elections were uncontested, but Dillingham voters weighed in on a four-way race for mayor. Incumbent Alice Ruby topped her challengers by a wide margin and will serve another three-year term. Ruby shared thoughts about the message behind the votes Tuesday night, just after the ballots had been tallied.
Well, I think that it means that what we've been working towards is something that the majority of the people have appreciated, and we'll continue to keep working hard. I think it also means that they see a hardworking council and they want us to keep working.
Bristol Bay Borough voters put Mary Swain and Carville Zimmon Jr. on the assembly in a three-way race for two open seats. The Bristol Bay Native Corporation held its annual shareholder meeting in Naknek last weekend, which included announcing election results for board of director seats. Sean Asplin, Pete Andrew, and Melvin Brown were re-elected to the board, and Kim Williams won a seat after running an independent campaign.
You know, it's been a two-month campaign, knocking on doors and visiting with shareholders from around the region and asking for their support to run as an independent candidate for a BBSC board. And I'm so thankful that many of them stopped and talked to me and they gave me their support. And for that, I'm grateful, but I think the work starts now.
BBNC President and CEO Jason Matrokin told KDLG News the corporation will benefit from new directors, saying there have been nine in the past 9 years.
I think it's going to be great for BBNC, some new fresh perspective, and the company is doing very well and arguably some challenging times economically, but it's always good to have fresh eyes and fresh perspective on the board.
The Pebble Mine was back in the news this week, first after dozens of mine opponents received subpoenas as part of a Pebble lawsuit against EPA and federal court. That case has moved to the discovery phase, and Pebble is hoping to put together a paper trail to back up its allegation that EPA improperly coordinated with anti-mine groups and individuals when it developed the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment and preemptive 404C restrictions. Attorney Vicki Clark with Trustees for Alaska was also served a subpoena, and she's representing many of others who did as well.
Their discovery request and the subpoenas are extremely broad and excessive. They're not just about communications with EPA, but they are about communications between private parties, just about anything to do with Pebble, and in some respects, mining in general in Alaska. So this is a pretty desperate attempt by Pebble to have a chilling effect on the opposition to the project.
Both sides it will take some time to sort out in court who will be required to turn over what material. On Tuesday morning, a Pebble-funded study by the Cohen Group made the claim that the EPA has acted unfairly in its actions to protect Bristol Bay. They said it should have waited for Pebble to enter the normal NEPA permitting process. Former U.S. Senator and Clinton Defense Secretary William Cohen slammed the agency's use of hypothetical mine scenarios and the proposed use of preemptive Clean Water Section 404C restrictions.
Basing a decision of this magnitude, and it has, you know, great impact potentially upon the salmon industry, upon the tribal customs and traditions, And it also has great potential from an economic development point of view. Given the magnitude of the issues involved, it seems to me it would have been certainly wiser, but I think ultimately much fairer to the state of Alaska and to Pebble to follow the normal procedure.
Critics pointed out that the report was funded by Pebble and came to the conclusion the mining company paid for. United Tribes of Bristol Bay's Alana Hurley spoke out against it Tuesday.
I think this is just another failed attempt to mislead the public to think that EPA somehow acted unfairly when that is exactly the opposite. EPA had an open and transparent process in Bristol Bay, and this is just another attempt by the Pebble Partnership with its highly paid consultants and misled lawsuits to delay the inevitable.
More on the Cohen report coming up in this show in a moment. Alaska Supreme Court Justice Dana Fabe announced this week that she'll retire next year from the bench. Fabe, who was the first woman appointed to serve on the court and the first to serve as Chief Justice, says it's been a tough decision to make.
I love the work so much, but it is a 24/7 job, and as a result, very difficult to do anything but the work. And so this will give me some opportunities to do some other things I'd like to do and still serve the court as a pro tem justice and find other ways to serve the people of Alaska.
Her retirement will be effective June 1st. The Department of Fish and Game released a forecast for next year's Togiak herring fishery, predicting more than 162,000 tons of herring spawning biomass. Area manager Tim Sands.
It's definitely a large biomass, and we're happy with that. We think that the biomass is stable there and sustainable, so that's a good thing.
That should leave 29,000 tons available for harvest, similar to last year. On our crime and safety beat, Dillingham police say they have not found the individual or individuals responsible for stealing and rolling a Dodge truck at the Boat Harbor last Saturday morning. Last week, police announced misdemeanor drug charges against the former manager of Grandma's House Assisted Living Center, who they allege was growing more than the legal amount of pot inside of the manager's apartment. A federal court jury in Anchorage convicted one of five former Excess Platinum mine officials on two misdemeanor charges of violating the Clean Water Act, essentially putting mine pollution into the Salmon River between 2010 and 2011. And the community of Hooper Bay is reeling from the suicide deaths of three young people in 2 weeks. The two men and one woman were all in their 20s. Troopers believe the latter two took their lives on account of being distraught from the death of the first young man. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. I'm Dave Benninger. The Pebble Partnership has made the claim for years that the EPA's involvement in the Bristol Bay watershed to block some large-scale mining is premature and unfair, or perhaps illegal. While the EPA's own Inspector General investigates that claim, Pebble has taken its fight to federal courts and to Congress. They say the fix was in all along, well before Area Tribe's 2010 request for the EPA to preemptively veto Pebble under Section 404C of the Clean Water Act. Using the Freedom of Information Act, Pebble has been trying to put together a paper trail to document the agency's dealings surrounding the proposed project and the Bristol Bay watershed. Pebble says the emails and documents they've obtained so far show EPA spent years planning a proactive, preemptive 404C veto, perhaps to set precedent for more agency watershed planning elsewhere in the future. The opposition says the Clean Water Act gives the EPA authority to protect the watershed whenever, and that Bristol Bay is too important to wait longer to take action on. Last spring, Pebble hired the Cohen Group, founded by former Senator and Clinton Defense Secretary William Cohen, to take a look at the matter. In a report issued this week, Cohen made the claim that EPA's actions have been unfair for stakeholders. That report gained attention in national media, which rankled Pebble's opposition to no end. Let's dig in a bit more here today with two viewpoints on the matter. In a moment, we'll hear from Joel Reynolds, the Western Director of the Natural Resources Defense Council, on why he says the report means little and got way too much media attention. But first, I'm joined now by Joe Ralston, a retired Air Force general and former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Ralston now serves as vice chairman of the Cohen Group and was involved in the review commissioned by Pebble. General, you were in Alaska. You're aware this is a controversial issue for many in the state, many in the country, but especially here in Bristol Bay. What was your take looking at the overall picture of the EPA's actions here?
Let me first of all say that I understand the complexities and I understand the the views within Alaska, both pro and con, of Pebble Mine. This review was not about the Pebble Mine. The review was about the actions of the EPA as a federal agency. And I think for those of us like Secretary Cohen, who spent his professional life in service of the country as a congressman, as a senator, as secretary of the largest department of the executive branch, I spent 38 years in service of the country. We feel very strongly that federal agencies should act in a fair, transparent way. That's the only way they can maintain the trust of the American public. And in this particular case, the question is, did the EPA act in a fair way and in a way that should engender the trust of the American people? That's what this report was about. It wasn't about whether Pebble Mine should or shouldn't be built.
You don't feel the EPA has acted fairly above board here or something. Can you describe, in your sense, a summary of what the findings were?
Yes, I will. The Pebble Mine, first of all, is a very, very important decision for all Alaskans and for all Americans, for that matter. And we believe, and the report, I think, outlines, that you should use the most complete and responsible process in making that decision as to whether Pebble should proceed or not. And in this particular case, for the first time in the 43-year history of the EPA has tried to use a preemptive veto of Section 404C of the Clean Water Act to prohibit an activity before a permit has ever been filed. And we have a longstanding process that all sides of the argument agree is a good process, the NEPA process. And it, for a decision of this magnitude, you should use the most thorough and comprehensive and accepted process, such as NEPA, and let's don't go and try something that's never been done ever before.
General, what's your sense of what was going on within the EPA? Just saying it's unfair is one thing, but what do you think was going on here?
Well, first of all, we're very clear to outline some things that we think need to be looked at by the appropriate people. We don't take, the Cohen Group and the report, doesn't take a position that there were illegal acts committed. There are troubling things that we think the legal system should look at. We don't take a position that a preemptive veto is outside the policy as outlined by the Congress of the United States, but it's something that we think should be looked at by the Congress of the United States. With regard to ethical operations inside the EPA and did they act fairly, that's appropriate for the Inspector General of the EPA to look at. But what I mean by troubling activities, when computer systems crash and emails are not recoverable by the EPA, when the EPA admits that they have a thumb drive with voluminous documents about this issue, but unfortunately they don't have the password to get into the thumb drive, that's troubling. And we think that people should take a look at that in depth. And that's what this report does.
You've been around the federal government off and on, I'm sure, through your entire career. What scale would you put this level of unfairness on that you've seen? Is this new to you? Do you think this is particularly egregious or particularly benign? How would you characterize it after this long review that's been undertaken here?
After looking at the documents that were obtained under the Freedom of Information Act and some of these troubling aspects, I would say that this is of certainly greater concern. Every agency, every department of government, they have things that go wrong, and we all understand that. But there seems to be far more troubling aspects of this than anything that I have dealt with before. And that's why, again, we're not saying that this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, but there are enough troubling aspects to it that those people who have the constituted responsibility to make sure that things go right need to take a deeper look at it, both the legal aspects, the ethical aspects, and the fairness aspects. this is not pro-pebble or anti-pebble. This, again, is for good governance about the actions of a federal agency.
Retired General Joseph Ralston is a former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and is a vice chairman of the Cohen Group, which released a report commissioned by Pebble this week. General, glad to have you on the program. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you this morning.
When announcements in the Pebble debate are made from either side, the reactions are swift. News email inboxes receive strongly worded rebuttals or support to whatever's making news on the matter, but this week was a little unique. The well-coordinated attack by Pebble's opposition seemed angrier about the Cohen report than usual, especially the print space and airtime it received from media outlets. For more on why that is, I'm joined by Natural Resources Defense Council's Joel Reynolds, whose own op-ed this week slammed Secretary Cohen as a bought and paid for mouthpiece for Pebble. Joel, it's been a while. Glad to have you back here on KDLG.
I'm glad to be back. Thanks.
Well, Joel, perhaps you can start us off here with a summary of your thoughts about this Cohen Group report.
Sure. I think the report is just a public relations stunt. It doesn't add anything to the very extensive record around EPA's review of the Pebble mine. First of all, it's not an independent report at all. It's entirely contracted for and funded by the Pebble Partnership. And so the notion that Secretary Cohen is kind of an independent third-party arbiter of disputes with EPA is ridiculous. Second, he conducted some kind of an unspecified review, interviewing a number of people whose names he doesn't disclose. He never talks about who refused to talk to him. And ultimately, he concludes that EPA's review, which took 4 years, in which there were repeated public comment periods, there were two separate scientific peer reviews. The Pebble Partnership was allowed to make as many comments as it wanted. There were over 1.1 million public comments, and Secretary Cohen somehow concludes that his review is an appropriate critique of that very extensive and transparent EPA scientific process. It's ridiculous. And then third, he goes on to say that EPA's proposed restriction of the Pebble mine is somehow unfair and inappropriate. This is a proposal to build one of the largest mines in the world and the headwaters of the greatest wild salmon fishery in the world. And he, Secretary Cohen, concludes somehow that it's EPA, by restricting this mine, not prohibiting it, but just restricting it, is unfair. Well, I actually find his report to be insulting of the people of Bristol Bay, disrespectful of all the work that they've engaged in now for years and years to protect their region. And I just can't say enough bad things about it. It doesn't add anything to the record. He has become a mouthpiece for the client that's paying him, and his review should simply be disregarded.
Let me read you something that they wrote in their report that involves you, in fact, or NRDC, rather. In their efforts to say that the NEPA process would have been the appropriate one, they say Natural Resources Defense Council has endorsed NEPA as, quote, democratic at its core, quote, when the government undertakes a major project such as constructing a dam, highway, or power plant, it must ensure that the project's impacts, environmental and otherwise, are considered and disclosed to the public. And because informed public engagement often produces ideas, information, and even solutions that the government might otherwise overlook, NEPA leads to better decisions and better outcomes for everyone. The NEPA process has saved money, time, lives, historical sites, endangered species, and public lands while encouraging compromise and cultivating better projects with more public support. End quote from NRDC. Joel, what's the problem with their argument that Pebble should be allowed to apply for permits and enter the NEPA process?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think there's some irony to the fact that a mining company that wants to gouge a two mile wide, 1 mile deep hole in the headwaters of a wild salmon fishery is defending NEPA. But putting that aside, I'm a big believer in NEPA. It's one of the the great laws that's been enacted in this country. And it attaches to any permit application for a major federal action. In this particular case, despite repeated promises for years, the Pebble Partnership hasn't filed a permit application. And they've ignored requests even from people like Senator Lisa Murkowski to do so because there's an enormous amount of anxiety, frustration, economic paralysis that results from this pebble mine hanging like a sword of Damocles over the Bristol Bay region. That's one point. The second point is that NEPA is one federal environmental process that applies when a permit application is filed. But the Federal Clean Water Act has for 40 years authorized the EPA to act under what's called Section 404C to protect the region from an activity or a particular project that will threaten certain resources like water, like fisheries, like recreational activities. EPA has very rarely used that in the 40-year history of the Act, maybe a dozen times. And it's proposing to use that here. NEPA does not apply to that. It doesn't need to apply to it because the section under the Clean Water Act is protective of natural resources. So if the company is concerned about getting EIS under NEPA, then it's within their own power simply to file a permit application, and that'll kick in a permit process as well as NEPA, but they haven't done it.
Well, what difference does it make if they apply for that this year, next year, or 15 years down the road? I gather that's what the report is indicating, is that it's up to Pebble to set the time frame for themselves, and the EPA can still revoke the permits immediately after the NEPA process is initiated.
Well, they certainly can. You're correct about that. They can file a permit application 50 years from now if they want. But that doesn't negate the authority that Congress gave the EPA to act today to protect a region from an activity that is going to have all kinds of adverse effects on protected resources. That's exactly what's going on here. So if Pebble doesn't like that, it can do two things. It can go to Congress and get that section revoked. It's not gonna win. But it can certainly do that. Or once EPA makes a final action under Section 404C, the company can go to court and challenge it.
Between the lawsuits, congressional hearings, and a presidential election right around the corner, it seems like the issue of Pebble Mine is far from being settled or resolved.
I think anybody who thinks that this battle is over is naive, because you have a company that has made very clear it's going to continue to pursue this. And I think ultimately there will be no mine built here, but there's a lot of work to do yet to make sure that that's the outcome.
All right. Joel Reynolds is the Natural Resources Defense Council's Western Director and the lead attorney on the campaign to stop Pebble Mine. Joel, good to speak with you. Thanks for coming on our program.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we did ask the EPA to join us today, hoping to hear from Region 10 Administrator Dennis McLaren himself, but the agency declined our requests, citing the current lawsuit in federal court. They did say by email that they stand behind their work and their process. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond. Back in a moment. If only Bristol Bay had the one environmental issue to worry about, but there are plenty of others. Erosion, discharge of fish waste, even disposing of normal trash is tricky and getting costly to deal with. Let's turn our attention specifically to Dillingham, which last year was forced by the state's Department of Environmental Conservation to do something other than burn its waste at the landfill. Limited by space and filled dirt to bury the trash, the city shopped around and bought an incinerator using funds from a state grant. But now, near the six-month mark of its operation, the city is finding that incinerating its trash isn't quite as straightforward as hoped. KDLG's Molly Dishner spoke with city officials and stopped by the landfill this week and has this story.
5 days a week, Dillingham's incinerator is burning tons and tons of trash. At the helm on a recent Monday morning was Brian Hoffman.
We take the garbage about anywhere between 1,500 to 2,200 pounds of waste goes into the buckets. We load it into the hopper, goes in the hopper, it burns. It just comes out at the end and a whole bunch of ash.
The key there is that it takes diesel to get the incinerator going. Once it starts burning, it mostly runs off its own heat, but it takes fuel to make a fire. The city used to burn its trash in open containers. That was cheap and effective at getting rid of it, but not exactly pleasant or environmentally friendly. Then the state DEC said it would no longer grant the city an open burning permit, so city manager Rose Loetta says it was time to find something new.
Once we knew that the deadline of June 1st, 2014 was looming, I had some encouragement to put pressure on DEC to allow us to open burn. And I told the council, I can't do that. I don't think it's in the best interest for us to allow that pollution to continue.
The city investigated its options. Burying trash is expensive because the city would have to buy dirt to cover trash every day. And that has its own problems. Animals can peck through the top layer. Compacted trash comes with the risk of leaching metal into the water table. City Council member Paul Liedberg says DEC was steering the city toward an incinerator.
They were looking for an alternative for rural areas and maybe to some degree were a test case. I think they were looking at this as an opportunity to deal with waste in the villages that might be better than the way many communities are disposing of all their trash.
Liedberg was part of the group that visited incinerators before the city made its purchase. They traveled to Igigik, which has had an incinerator for years, and Pennsylvania to look at incinerators made by Penram, the company the city eventually bought from. Liedberg says it's too early to say whether the model they bought was the right choice.
Well, I think, you know, there was a lot of variables early on, and there still is variables on how we operate the incinerator. And I think we probably need to get through a year here before we can really make that call on whether this was the best alternative or not, or the best way to go.
The incinerator the city finally chose was expected to use about 61 gallons of diesel every time it got going. But it turns out there were a few problems with that estimate. There are a lot of variables in how much fuel is used, how many times the incinerator starts and stops, what it's burning, and how much trash there is to burn. And even the amount of trash Dillingham generated was hard to predict. In September, the city estimated that it would take about 35 gallons of diesel in a year. But even that's not for sure. Loetta says it took some time to get operations dialed in out at the landfill.
We were still during the summer adjusting the burn cycles, the burners, and the type of garbage we're putting in, et cetera, et cetera. So right now, I think we're at, you know, if we burn 24 hours, we're anywhere between 120 gallons to 150 gallons.
Right now, the machine only operates for about 6 to 8 hours a day because of staffing, so Public Works has to decide each week how much to burn and what to bury. Next week, they'll try to change the staffing pattern and burn longer hours. Loetta says they'll keep tweaking operations until they find the best system.
They're keeping logs out there every day, how much they burn, how much fuel they accumulate, and we just need to study that a little bit, and we will do that this winter.
They might look to the public for a little help dialing it in, too. They've said all along that glass messes up the incinerator. It turns out metal is a problem, too.
We may need to increase our metal separation. There's some vents in the incinerator that just got plugged, a couple of them, like three of them, I believe, and it turned out to be aluminum that was plugging them up. So we may need to expand our recycling efforts.
Loetta says the landfill's budget this year was estimated at about $370,000, based on the city's best guess of how much trash there would be and how much fuel would be used. She isn't sure what the final cost will come in at. Fuel use is higher than expected, but diesel has been cheaper.
We'll do the best we can, try to keep it within that budget area, but that's really an unknown. It's something we have to do.
And at the end of the day, Dillingham has to deal with its garbage, whatever the cost may be. So city employees like Hoffman will keep firing up the incinerator and burying the ash it produces.
Roughly about 2 totes a day, less than all the garbage.
In Dillingham, I'm Molly Dishner.
And finally, on this week's show, KDLG's Hannah Colton visited the elementary school this week on word of a new piece of fitness equipment that staff have been raising money towards for years. Now that it's in, the new addition is driving kids and teachers up the wall, or should I say, across it.
Keep your feet at this line and traverse across. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So do you need to go above the loop?
No.
PE teacher Teresa Duncan steps off a thick floor mat onto green and yellow plastic footholds. She's showing a class of third graders how to keep their feet in the bottom third of the 8-foot-high wall.
Being up high isn't as important sometimes as the stretches you're going to get.
Duncan has been prepping her elementary gym classes with safety instructions for several days, and now they're ready to try it out. This group makes their way slowly, single file, across the 60 feet of traversing wall.
My name is Liam Gross, and I've been climbing on the climbing wall like 4 times now.
It's kind of challenging, not too much though. The tiny handholds over there are really hard.
Do you like to find the tinier ones,
yeah,
the harder ones? Why?
Because it's really challenging and it gives me more muscle.
For now, Duncan is just having the students practice climbing from one end to the other. But she's as excited as the kids are about trying new things on the wall. She shows me a set of handholds designed to hold hula hoops vertically that students then have to navigate around.
I mean, that's going to be fun. There's just so many different things you can do with it. And the kids have taught me different ways that we can work with it. And I love the idea of latching together with a hoop in between. And you could even do 3 or 4 people. And so you have to really, really coordinate and talk to each other. It's communication.
My name is Cassidy Knutson. It's fun being challenging because you could do it over and over again to see how fast you could get.
Seeing these kids take on the wall is a long-time dream for retired elementary school principal Marilyn Rosine. She's been fundraising for this equipment since 2009.
People were, what are you raising money for? What are you raising money for? And we'd give some away to, you know, hurricane victims and things like that in another account. And then it was just, I really don't know. We were just kind of talking, and I have some other friends who work in schools with climbing walls, and we're always concerned about upper body strength for our kids and exercise. And the weather is such that we can't always be outside, and it just... just kind of came together. Well, what about a climbing wall?
6 years and over $16,000 later, Rosine was finally able to order the 3 20-foot slabs of wall from a company in Minnesota. They were installed over the summer. At a school assembly celebrating the climbing wall Wednesday morning, Principal Nick Schulmeyer unveiled its official name, the Rosine Traversing Wall.
I was certainly not expecting that. I mostly was just tickled. I wanted to get it up while I was still working here, and just didn't happen. But Nick's been great to work with, and so no, that's certainly a tremendous honor. But it's a community climbing wall. So
Rosine and Duncan hope kids and community members will have fun, get stronger, and maybe even be inspired to take up a new sport.
Rock climbing is big everywhere. This gives them a new avenue of exercise and enjoyment and a vacation plan. Myself included, I had never thought about rock climbing, and now I am.
As anyone who's climbed knows, the first few times are killer on your hands.
Ow, my hands hurt.
They're really sore.
My hands got a little bit of blisters.
Mine got too sweaty.
What are your hands feeling now?
Numb.
Not to worry, parents. Your kids should be proudly sporting some new calluses and arm muscles in no time. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
And that's it for this week's show. We ran out of time to include a segment with our friend Gabe Dunham with good advice on how to winterize boats. So if you want an excuse to put that project off a bit longer, we'll have that on next Friday. Instead of working on the boat, step outside tonight and take a gander skyward. The UAF Geophysical Institute is predicting another night of high aurora activity. Northern lights visible if the weather allows for much of Bristol Bay. Find this and past episodes of Bristol Bay and Beyond at our website, and keep in touch with feedback and ideas. Shoot me an email at dave@kdlg.org. I'm Dave Benninger. Hope to see you back here next week.